Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star, then the number one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us on our monthly climate call, which is part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. Again, my name is Brady Phillips, public officer with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, and I'll be facilitating the call today. So we will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question-and-answer session. And we'll be following along a presentation that you can download online at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BREFINGS. It's also on a linked in the media advisory. Our first presenter today is Jake Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's Climate Monitoring Branch in the National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina, who will provide a summary of the August U.S. Climate Report and the Drought Monitor released earlier today. Just as a side note, NOAA is not releasing its global U.S. climate highlights for August until September 20th, so we'll not be speaking to that directly today. The next presenter is David Zierden, the Florida State climatologist located at Florida State University. We'll discuss the recent rainfall in the Florida Panhandle and some dryness located along their east coast. And our final presenter will be Matthew Rosenkranz, head of forecast operations at the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's Operational Prediction Branch in College Park, Maryland, who will provide us the latest La Nina update as well as the monthly seasonal temperature, precipitation, drought outlooks for the coming 3 months, which, believe it or not, puts us at the end of the calendar year. So we'll begin with Jake from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information. Jake?
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number two on the slide decks that you can download. As Brady mentioned, our global report will be coming out on Tuesday, the 20th. The way the calendar worked with us this month, with the third Thursday being fairly early in the month, we weren't able to get that report out before this call. Looking at what happened across the contiguous U.S. during August of 2016, the average temperature across the lower 48 was about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and that was the 17th warmest August on record for the contiguous U.S. The graphic on the left shows statewide temperature ranks during the month of August. You can see that California was much warmer than average, as well as much of the Midwest, Southeast, and Northeast. And in the Northeast, we had eight states that were record warm for the month: Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. We did see below average and near average temperatures across parts of the Great Plains, Rockies, as well as the Southwest. Above average precipitation in parts of those regions helped to suppress daytime temperatures and keep the average temperature for the month of August closer to average and below average for those regions. Looking at precipitation, it was the second wettest August on record for the contiguous U.S. The precipitation averaged across the country was 3.47 inches, 0.85 inches above average, and only 1977 was wetter in terms of August precipitation. The graphic on the right shows statewide precipitation ranks. We can see that above average precipitation stretching across much of the central U.S. from the Southwest, Southern Plains, Central Plains, Midwest, as well as the lower Mississippi River Valley, where we had the record flooding impact Louisiana during the month, where at least 13 fatalities were reported. Parts of Louisiana did observe over 30 inches of rainfall in mid-August associated with that heavy rainfall event. We did see drier than average conditions for parts of the country, particularly the West and the Northern Rockies, as well as parts of the East Coast. In the West, as Louisiana was dealing with the record-breaking flooding, there were several large wildfires burning with several hundreds of homes destroyed as well. So an interesting dichotomy there with wildfires burning in the West and parts of Louisiana under nearly 3 feet of water. Moving on to slide number three to look at summer conditions for the lower 48. The average temperature for the contiguous U.S. was 2.1 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this was the fifth warmest June through August on record for the country. Every state, as you can see on the graphic on the left, was warmer than average for that three-month period, with much warmer than average conditions across the west, southwest, and for much of the east. There were three states, California, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, that were each record warm for the summer period. when we look at separately at daytime and nighttime temperatures for the season, summer nighttime temperatures were record high for the summer period. There's some important impacts there. When nighttime temperatures don't drop very much, that more energy is used to cool homes, and there are also impacts in terms of agriculture as well as human health. One of the reasons that nighttime temperatures were so warm, particularly in the eastern United States, was relatively high dew point temperatures. The graphic on the right shows station-based dew point departures from average. The dots and the brighter red colors indicates locations that had higher than average moisture during the summer season. More moisture and those warm temperatures combined to create really high heat indices. So that's the temperature that it feels like to the human body. Those increased nighttime temperatures as well as increased precipitation for many locations. And then in the west, we did see below average dew points, and that is associated with those ideal wildfire conditions with several large fires burning across the region. Moving on to slide number four to look at Alaska. Alaska has been incredibly warm now, dating back over 5 years. The table on the left shows several time periods stretching from 1 month back to 5 years, showing how the Alaska temperature compares to the period of record there that dates back to 1925. So August was the third warmest for the state, summer the second warmest. Then from the six-month period all the way back to the 48-month period, has been record warm for the state, and then the most recent five-year period has been second warmest. I highlight there the 12-month average temperature, so that's from September 2015 through August 2016, and the statewide average temperature was 32.3 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the first time that any 12-month average temperature for Alaska has exceeded 32 degrees over the freezing point, so an interesting milestone that has been reached there in Alaska with that incredible warmth that has been observed across the state. Moving on to slide number five to look at the drought monitor that was released this morning. About 18.3% of the contiguous U.S. is in drought, and this is down about 2.8 percentage points since early August. We did see some drought improvement across the northern and southern Great Plains, Midwest, and parts of the southeast where precipitation was observed. In the southeast, precipitation wasn't very widespread, so those locations that did not observe rainfall continue to be in drought, particularly parts of northern Alabama and northern Georgia. We did see drought conditions degrade across the northern and central Rockies, the northeast, and mid-Atlantic. In the northeast, you can see that much of the western New York, parts of eastern Massachusetts, eastern New Hampshire are in D3 or extreme drought. This is the first time many locations in the northeast since the drought monitor inception have been in severe extreme drought. And this is actually the worst drought on record for Massachusetts since the drought of the 1960s. So some interesting conditions in that part of the country. And outside of the contiguous U.S., we continue to see improving drought conditions for Alaska and in Hawaii, where several tropical cyclones impacted the state, as well as Puerto Rico. And with that, I will pass it off to David.
David, if you're there, I think you need to unmute your phone. Thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did have my phone on mute. I want to thank you, Jake. I was invited to participate in this presentation today to talk about the weather and climate conditions this summer in the state of Florida. And I can summarize them as hot, humid. There were both wet and dry areas and impact from hurricane. In other words, conditions were about what we expected, but more of it. We'll begin with slide number six and summarize the impacts from Hurricane Hermine that made landfall along the coast of the Appalachian Bay late night of September 1st, early morning of September 2nd. This was the first hurricane landfall for the state of Florida in over 10 years. The previous one being Wilma in 2005. It's also the first landfall along this area of the coast since 1966. Hermine came ashore as a weak Category 1 with estimated winds at 80 miles per hour and a 982 millibar central pressure. It did bring a significant storm surge, estimated at 4 to 6 feet along Wakulla County's shoreline and 8 to 9 feet along the Dixie County shoreline, which was nearing the record marks from the March 1993 superstorm. One of the major impacts were downed trees and loss of power in the Tallahassee area and across North Florida. In Tallahassee itself, 80% of customers lost power from this storm, and most of those lost power for an extended period of time, 3 days, even up to a week. The hurricane also brought tornadoes with it. During the storm, there were 13 tornado warnings issued in the area, with three confirmed tornado touchdowns in Taylor County. One of the other major impacts from this hurricane was the widespread heavy rainfall, which you can see on the bottom left image is the storm estimated totals from NEXRAD radar. A broad area in red of over 4 inches, over 5 inches there in Tallahassee and Leon County, and totals even 8 inches and higher near Cedar Key and the Big Bend of Florida. And this heavy rainfall extended across southeast Georgia and across much of North and South Carolina also. Moving on, next slide, number 7, is a graphic released from NOAA earlier this week, and it just shows selected record and near-record temperature and rainfall for the summer of 2016. What we'll notice here is across much of the eastern United States, we see a number of near-record and record warm temperatures for the 2016 summer. Also, what of interest that I will go into more detail on is along the northeast coast of Florida, we had two stations, Jacksonville and Daytona Beach, set records for the driest summer on record. So we'll go into a little bit more detail on that. But first, on the next slide, slide number 8, we'll talk about the summer heat and some of the records that were set. This summer was unusual in the state of Florida. For the June through August period, we were the third warmest on record statewide, but July was also the record warmest for the state of Florida and the second warmest month ever recorded across the state of Florida. What's been unusual about this this heat is that it hasn't been just one or two severe heat waves. It's more been just a constant heat. For example, Orlando set a record for record warmest July, but did not set a single daily heat record during that time. Tallahassee had its third warmest July, but likewise did not set a single daily heat record. On the other hand, it's been the overnight minimum temperatures that have been much warmer than normal. And we can kind of illustrate that during the summer, there were 253 afternoon maximum temperatures broken or tied, but three times as many, or 646 overnight minimum temperature tied or broken. We also had some very unusual streaks of hot weather. Over on the left, the graphic shows the streaks of consecutive days with afternoon temperatures of 90 degrees or higher. And what sticks out, Athens, Georgia had a streak of 52 days. Savannah and Daytona Beach had record streaks of 69 and 63 days. And then you see many other streaks in the 40s and 30s also. So it was very much a constant heat. And I also spoke of these overnight minimum temperatures. Here at Tallahassee, we had a streak of 74 consecutive days with overnight low temperatures at 72 degrees or above. And all but one of those nights, that overnight temperature was above normal. So it was 2.5 months of above normal overnight low temperatures. On the next slide, slide number nine, we'll start talking about the dryness along the northeast coast of Florida. And I have two graphics on the left side. The top left shows average rainfall for the month of August. And you'll notice that the west side of the state and the peninsula tends to be wetter than the dry side. And that's due to prevailing easterly winds, and the sea breeze initiated convection tends to form further inland and over on the west side of the state rather than along the east coast of Florida. On the bottom left, we'll look at actual radar estimates for August of this year. And we see that same east to west gradient in rainfall, the west side getting heavier amounts, and the east side less. But this is more accentuated than the average, and that's because the subtropical high has been a little stronger and a little further north and west than it normally is, leading to more days of this predominantly easterly flow. And also on that bottom left graphic, you can see heavy rainfall along the Big Bend of Florida, and that was from the same system that brought the devastating floods to Louisiana as it drifted westward. Over on the right-hand side is an estimate of rainfall deficits over the last 90 days. And there you can really see the red indicating deficits of 8 to 12 inches or more along the Jacksonville and Daytona Beach area and across the entire northeast Florida area. So the dryness there is very much confined to the coastal areas and really hasn't had a tremendous impact on agriculture or water supply yet. So because it's so confined to the coast, and we are still in the summer rainy season, this area is only considered abnormally dry, or D0, on the U.S. drought monitor. And I think that wraps up mine, so I will pass it along to Matthew Rosenkranz to give the outlook for the fall.
Good morning, everybody. This is Matthew Rosenkranz, the head of forecast operations at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. On slide 10, that references the sea surface temperatures and the latest state of the El Niño Southern Oscillation System. The sea surface temperatures across the Central Pacific, specifically along the equator, remain to be below normal for the month of August. The actual data that we had was from 14 August through the 10th of September. That is the latest data, and that shows below normal temperatures, generally from about a half degree centigrade to about 2 degrees below, 2 degrees centigrade below, centigrade below normal. The largest and the most intense concentration of below normal temperatures, sea surface temperatures that is, are about 150 degrees west, so a little bit far out into the Central Pacific, not quite along the west coast of the Americas. Another feature that stands out over the Pacific is the abnormally warm sea surface temperatures extending all the way from near the coast of northern Japan all the way to the Bering Sea, Bering Strait, and also the north central Pacific. Some of those anomalies are 3 degrees and greater above normal, 3 degrees centigrade above normal. We've also noticed above normal sea surface temperatures for the month of August for much of the central Atlantic and the western Atlantic as well, including the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. Going forward, the forecast for the El Niño Southern Oscillation, we've actually had a change since last month. Last month, we had a La Niña watch out. This month, the models and the statistics are showing that we're not favoring La Niña anymore. We are favoring ENSO neutral conditions through the fall and winter of this year. So going from fall 2016 through all the way through December, January, and February of 2017, we are forecast favoring ENSO neutral conditions. So the El Niño Southern Oscillation Alert System is now not active, and the probabilities for ENSO neutral conditions are between 55 and 60%. That's through the winter. As we go out into the spring, we return to near normal. We're favoring near normal conditions and favoring climatological probabilities for neutral conditions by March, April, May. Given that, the ENSO impact into the forecast is then reduced because there's going to be not as strong of an ENSO signal. So the downstream impacts from any changes in the Pacific would be lessened and over the U.S. So if we talk about slide 11, the monthly forecast, it has a lot of considerations. The monthly forecast for October has a lot of considerations from the dynamical models and from the current state of soil moisture. Previous forecasts, previous presenters have talked about increased soil moisture and increased precipitation across the center part of the U.S., and that played a role in the forecast as well. The forecast for October has mainly above normal temperatures forecast are favored for most of the U.S., with the main weakness in that where we actually have where we're not forecasting or not favoring above normal temperatures, that's over the south central plains and into the central plains part of the U.S., where for the month of August was some record wet conditions. So those wet conditions in August are can actually have a lingering effect and have some keep the temperatures down a little bit for the next month or two across the central part of the U.S. So that's why the probabilities there are lowest. We have strong trends in the southwest and strong trends in the northeast, as well as strong trends over the northern part of Alaska and the western part of Alaska, where sea surface temperatures are above normal, wrapping around the state of Alaska. So we have very high probabilities for above normal temperatures across the north slope of Alaska and the western part of Alaska. Strong trends for above normal temperatures over the southwest and over the northeast CONUS. For precipitation, we are forecasting above median precipitation for the south and west coast of Alaska, mainly due to the above normal sea surface temperatures and lowered sea ice coverage. The moisture is able to stream inland further, and you get storms that are picking up more liquid moisture from the ocean and more moisture from the ocean rather than storms that move over ice-covered water, which can't pick up as much moisture. Over the CONUS, we are forecasting below median precipitation for the Pacific Northwest, a stripe of above normal precipitation in the from the central plains, say Illinois, over to New Mexico, northeast New Mexico. And then we're also forecasting a continuation of the dry conditions over the southeast, potentially exacerbating some of the drought that's going on in northern Georgia and into Alabama as well. Moving on to slide 12, the seasonal outlook. The seasonal outlook for October, November, December of 2016 has a strong favoring for above normal temperatures along the north slope of Alaska and a very strong favoring of above normal temperatures for the southwest, where the trends in the autumn and the winter temperatures are the highest. We do have a lot of uncertainty stretching from the northern plains to the southeast, so we do have mostly above normal temperatures favored for the northern plains and a little bit into the Ohio Valley, but they're only weakly favored for above. By the time we get to this, if we consider the southeast U.S., we don't have a real strong climate signal there. Some of the tools we look at that could be looked at looking at sea surface temperature patterns around the world give us some cold signals, some give us some warm signals, some models give us some mixed signals. So we don't have a strong signal in the southeast, so we have an equal chances forecast from about Kentucky down to Florida. The seasonal outlook for precipitation favors above normal precipitation for western Alaska, much for the same reasons that the October forecast favors above normal precipitation for much of Alaska. That is, open waters, allowing more moisture to stream inland, along with low pressure systems that move into the state of Alaska. We are favoring continued dry conditions across the southeast and the southern tier of the U.S., basically from Texas all the way over to the southeast coast. There's not a real strong La Nina signal for October, November. There's a little La Nina signal in December, but the real strong signals for La Nina, or if that does evolve, or any impact even from a weak La Nina that wouldn't reach our actual declared La Nina threshold of minus 0.5 degrees, would be more towards January and February. So that's not really considered in the October, November, December outlook. But the model forecasts and the trends in the fall do have dry conditions across the southeast, so that's what our forecast favors. Slide 13 is the U.S. drought outlook. Corresponding to the continued dry conditions forecast in the southeast, there's a large area of drought expansion favored in the southeast, stretching from central Virginia all the way to northern Mississippi and to southwest Georgia. Along with some potential, then on the flip side, with some potential storm activity moving into the northwest and northern Rockies. There's some drought improvement and drought removal forecast for western Oregon and Washington. And for some of the storm activity moving into the Rockies, there's some drought removal and improvement forecast for Montana, Wyoming, and into the Badlands of South Dakota. And so with that, that's all I have, and I'll turn it back to Brady.
Thank you, Matthew. We'll now turn to take specific questions from some of you who have called in. And again, as a reminder, please be sure to indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if possible. And operator, can you please remind the participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks.
Yes, thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. The first question comes from Seth Bornstein from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I guess this is for Jake, but if David wants to jump in, it's along both lines. Looking at both the nighttime temperatures and the dew points, first, if you can explain a little bit further why their connection. But on the dew points, I'm wondering, I like that graphic. Do you have any indication on how unusual this was? Is there any sort of less sort of records? And what, given sort of the nighttime precip, the dew points, high dew point issues, and then the extendedness, can you tell maybe what is going on here and how extreme is this in comparison to previous summers? And if you can look at the whole summer, the June, August, and even if you want to toss in May, since it, for many of us, May is sort of summer now.
Hey, Seth, this is Jake. So looking at that slide number 3, with the dew point departures from average, we did not calculate an unusualness factor here, so we didn't rank those dew points, but we probably could do that fairly easily, and we could probably put that online and to give some more context in terms of those dew points. In terms of what the relationship between the dew points and overnight lows and precipitation, so the dew point is a measure of the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. The more moisture in the atmosphere, that means that the overnight lows can't cool down as much. So some basic meteorology, the temperature, observed temperature will never be below the observed dew point temperature. So if dew point temperatures are higher, overnight low temperatures will also be higher. That has impacts in terms of the heat index during the day and then those overnight lows during the night. And one of the things that we're observing with our changing climate, as the climate warms, more moisture is in the atmosphere. So these increased dew points are kind of consistent with that expectation of more moisture in the atmosphere. And even though there's more moisture in the atmosphere, that doesn't necessarily mean that it precipitated out. Yes, during the summer, there were several large singular precipitation events, the flooding in West Virginia, the flooding in Kentucky, the flooding in Louisiana, but not everywhere saw those heavy precipitation events. So there are a couple of connections there between those increased dew points, warm overnight lows, and specific precipitation events.
And in terms of, basically, is this sort of playing out like the summers we have been told about for decades with anthropogenic warming, the very moist, extremes, whether it's, West Virginia, Louisiana, or the lack thereof in the Northeast and Northeast Florida? And, of course, as always, seems like California. Is this sort of the signature summer that we've been told about?
So with the long-term warming trend and that expectation of increased moisture and that moisture falling out in singular events, so heavy singular precipitation events, and also where it's not precipitating, becoming drier, I think this summer is a pretty good example of that in terms of the singular flooding events that I mentioned, as well as the drought in the Northeast, continuing drought in the West, and also what we saw in the east coast of Florida.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi. When you look at the dew points and as well as the temperatures in Alaska over the last 12 months, I mean, how alarming is this? What should the public be taking away from this kind of data?
One of the things that we have observed is that the cold parts of the world and the cold parts of the day are warming fastest. So the high latitudes are warming faster than the lower latitudes, and overnight temperatures are warming faster than daytime temperatures. And that kind of manifested itself in terms of what we saw in Alaska this year, you know, dating back over 5 years, and what we observed with those overnight lows here in the lower 48. So I think that the takeaway is, you know, this is the expectation of a warming climate that we're currently observing.
How far back do the records go in Alaska? I'm sorry.
The statewide records for Alaska go back to 1925.
Okay. Thanks, Jay.
The next question comes from Doyle Rice with USA Today. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this, as always. Just two questions. One is, you mentioned that this could be the worst drought in Massachusetts since the 60s. Is that could that be true for all of New England, or was it specifically Massachusetts? Maybe that's a question for the drought monitor folks.
This is Jake. I'll take a stab at that. So the drought of the 1960s in the Northeast was very widespread. It impacted regions from Pennsylvania to Maine, and it's pretty much the drought of record for that region of the country. Looking at the drought monitor from this morning, the current drought in that region tends to be split up. So there's the drought along the coast that's impacting Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and there's also the severe drought and extreme drought in western New York. It looks like it's being split down the middle by the mountain chain that runs through that part of the country. So this drought is obviously different than the drought of the 1960s in terms of the spatial extent and the locations being impacted. But I was looking just at Massachusetts, since this is the first time that D3 conditions have ever been declared in Massachusetts since the drought monitor began over a decade ago.
Okay. And the second one is, you mentioned that kind of we're now into a La Nina. I don't know if you guys use that term, La Nina, or the ENSO neutral. How often is that we've had winters with this, you know, ENSO neutral over the last few? And is it harder to come up with a specific forecast when you don't have the strong El Nino or La Nina signal?
Hey, this is Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Predictor. The climatological probabilities are just slightly below 30%, so about 28-29% for being in ENSO neutral during December, January, February, and November, December, January. By the time you get to January, February, March, those climatological probabilities come up, and they're about 38% during January, February, March. So we're actually, the probability of having ENSO neutral, one of three phases, is actually slightly less than one-third during the core winter, December, January, February, so you're more likely to have the other two categories. Mm-hmm. The putting together an outlook for the winter without a strong El Nino or La Nina signal, what it does is it increases uncertainty because that is the major climate signal over the season. So when you remove this large-scale background forcing, you allow other forcing mechanisms in the atmosphere that potentially have shorter impact periods. So whereas La Nina could impact the entire 90 days, we might have a period where the Arctic Oscillation goes extremely negative for only 30 days, and then it goes extremely positive for 30 days. And getting those shorter-term variations within the longer-term climate record is much more difficult to predict. So it does add a lot of uncertainty to the forecast going forward, which is one reason why the forecast maps that came out this month have lower probabilities and less coverage of where we where we still have our climate models and our tools giving us signals because of there's a less of a background forcing.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Molly Samuel with WABE. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thanks for holding this. With the drought developing in North Georgia and around Atlanta, I mean, it's been kind of taking shape all summer, and I'm wondering if you all see it kind of shifting from a short-term impact to a long-term impact with your fall outlook, and if you could kind of talk about what some of those impacts could mean, what it would mean as it lingers on into the end of the year.
This is Matt Rosenkranz. Since we do the drought outlook, I can take that one. We do actually see it coming for, shifting from a short-term impact to a long-term impact, to a long-term drought. Typical impacts for the I'm trying to actually look them up, the meanings of the drought impacts. Background. Classification scheme. So potential impacts. If we go from a D3 to a D4 drought over much of the southeast, right now there's some pockets of what we call D3, which are extreme drought, over North Georgia and Northeast Alabama. Most of the state, most of the area, that probably looks like about, if I go to Georgia, right now, just about one-third, 29.49% of Georgia is actually in D2, which is severe drought, or greater. So D2, D3, and D4 sum up to be 29%. So if we do see this continue and become more intense and become more entrenched and we get to D3 and D4 categories, at a D4, we would expect shortages in water reservoirs, such as Lake Lanier, major reservoirs like that being drawn down to levels where local municipalities and local governments would have to issue water restrictions. Failures in streams, failures in local wells, and exceptional and widespread crop and pasture losses. D3, where we are noticing, we already have some areas of D3 in Georgia and Alabama, major crop and pasture losses, and smaller scale water shortages and restrictions, not major cities, but smaller municipalities issuing water restrictions, you know, no washing of cars, watering of lawns down to once a week, or no watering of lawns at all, whatever each local municipality needs to do based on their local reservoir storage capacity.
Hi, and this is David Zierden. We are involved in the National Integrated Drought Information System pilot in the Apalachicola, Chattahoochee, Flint River Basin, and we've been holding biweekly webinars with representatives from the Army Corps of Engineers, USGS, and the National Weather Service River Forecast Center to assess the state of drought in the ACF basin and provide early warning. And from these webinars, I can tell you that the flows on the Chattahoochee River near Columbus are at near record lows for this time of year. Flows from the Apalachicola River into Apalachicola Bay and estuary have been very low all summer long. And with the prospect, which was previously a higher probability, but still there is a remaining prospect of slipping into La Nina conditions this winter. That brings warmer than normal temperatures and drier than normal conditions to much of the ACF basin during the critical winter and spring recharge season. So, yeah, the prospects of a longer-term drought are very real and very concerning. Some impacts, whether it's directly related to lower flows this year or not. The Florida FWC has surveyed the oyster bars and main harvesting areas of Apalachicola Bay and determined that they are far below normal still, and populations are below last year even. So they are tightening bag restrictions and this oyster crisis is really continuing to plague the coastal towns there.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Ned Dickman from the Great Lakes Boating Federation. Your line is open.
Thank you, and thank all our climatologists that gave us a good review about the weather and what's to be expected. I represent the 4.3 million boaters here on the Great Lakes. They are very concerned about water lake levels, and their homes are nearby, their boats are in many marinas, and we would like very much to know what to expect in the days to come on lake levels, water levels. I haven't heard much of that being addressed during this meeting here today. Could one of the climatologists tell us what to expect as far as the lake levels to come? Because a lot of these boaters do depend on being able to moor properly. Some have flotation devices, many, and some are fixed mooring systems, which could pretty much be underwater if the lake levels rise too much.
this is Jake. I'll take a first stab at this. In terms of lake levels over the past couple of years, we've seen some pretty large swings in terms of the water level in the Great Lakes, where we went from near-record low levels to near-record high levels in just a couple of months. I haven't looked at the recent water level there. The NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab, the GLERL, does monitor daily water levels on each of the lakes and provides forecasts, so they might be able to provide a little more context. But looking at what happened this summer in terms of precipitation, the western part of the Great Lakes were fairly wet. As that moisture falls on the western Great Lakes basin, it flows to the east. So that would, to me, indicate that we would at least expect water levels to remain at their current levels or a little bit higher than they are right now. Looking at the outlook from Matthew, you know, there seems to be equal chances in terms of above average or below average precipitation in that region. So, to me, that would indicate, you know, status quo. But I would defer to the GLERL, the NOAA lab that monitors Great Lakes water levels, for the exact answer there.
Yep, this is Matt Rosenkranz. I do have the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab website open, and according to Lake Superior, their water levels in Marquette, they are slightly above their September normals. They've come up in the past couple of weeks. There are many, many graphics on the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab website, so you can delve into there and get the actual numbers and data. We are above 2015 levels. The outlooks that we have, October, November, December, they do have some above-normal precipitation into the northern Rockies. One consistent signal we did notice in a lot of the model forecasts is essentially what we would term an active northern stream, which would be more repetitive storm activity moving across the northern Rockies to the Great Lakes to the northeast. If I were to show the November, December, January, and December, January, February outlooks, those actually do bring above normal precipitation across much of the northern plains into the Great Lakes. So kind of to expand beyond the time range of this briefing, going out into the winter, we might expect some more precipitation across the Great Lakes, which could potentially raise lake levels and keep them above last year's levels. But again, the experts on the inflows and outflows of the Great Lakes are the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab.
Thank you.
Our final question comes from Kit Doloff with Santa Barbara Independent. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is a drought question. So Santa Barbara and Ventura counties are kind of at the epicenter of the most serious drought nation. The drought in the West has waxed and waned somewhat, but once we hit D5, we've stayed there. So the question, is there anything about our current climatology and this location that indicates this might persist?
This is Matt. The classification for Central and Southern California is absolutely at D4, which is the exceptional drought category, which is the most intense category of drought that we currently have. It is the fifth level, but we have a D0. We start at zero, the numbering system. We don't start at one.
Okay.
Then the outlook going forward actually has persistence for most of that area, which would indicate a continuation of the dry conditions and potentially even expansion of the D4 into areas that are now D3. D3 basically goes up from the eastern San Francisco Bay to the Sacramento area, straight up to the central Sierras, and all the way down into Central Valley and straight down south into basically the midpoint of the the California-Mexico border, almost down to the Salton Sea. So most of that area is covered in D3, and I expect a lot of that to turn to D4 if the winter rains don't materialize. Which, even though we don't have a La Nina forecast, we are forecasting below normal sea surface temperatures in the central Pacific. So that doesn't give us a strong reflection of La Nina, which would be dry in the southwest and along the entire southern tier of the U.S. So now, with a weaker La Nina, we're noticing weaker probabilities for below normal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks everyone, and I think we're running low on time, so I'm going to wrap it up with a few reminders. The September U.S. Climate Highlights will be released on October 6th, and the September Global Climate Highlights will be released on October 18th. Just as an additional reminder, the August Global Climate Highlights will be released on September 20th, so next Tuesday, so be alert for that. Also, next month, in lieu of having this regularly scheduled monthly climate call, NOAA will issue its winter outlook on Thursday, October 20th. We'll have a separate media call focused on that topic, and a separate media advisory will be put out for that call. So in the meantime, if you do have further questions or need additional follow-up, please feel free to email me, brady.phillips@noaa.gov. or my colleague John Leslie, john.leslie@noaa.gov. Thanks again for your participation. This concludes the call. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.